The first child care bill to gain traction in a decade weaves its way through the State House. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, March 4th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with Representative Aaron Healy about House Bill 1132. It's all about giving child care workers incentives so fewer leave the workforce to care for their own kids. Opponents say it chooses winners and losers in the child care crisis. Proponents say it is an important step to keeping child care centers in business. Mike Thompson is with us for a look at a U.S. Supreme Court case where Mexico is suing American gun manufacturers. Plus, how do teachers help students become good classmates? We'll talk about social-emotional learning on today's Teacher Talk. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. House Bill 1132 recently passed in the House and is headed for the Senate. The bill establishes provisions for eligibility in the Child Care Assistance Program for certain child care employees. HB 1132 is sponsored by Representative Aaron Healy from District 10 and Senator Tim Reid from District 7. We connected with Representative Healy from the SDN Communications Studio in Pierre.
I'll start with the gaps in childcare right now. We all know that there's a childcare crisis. So we have issues with access. It's really hard to find childcare. We also have issues in South Dakota with affordability. It's incredibly expensive. It costs roughly between $7,000 to $14,000 to send your child to childcare. And so we know that it's really expensive for parents. It's also very expensive for the providers. As we know, operational costs continue to increase as we see inflation rise. So it's been a really hard time, too, for operationally for our providers to keep their doors open. And then the third problem that we know that exists within childcare is the workforce. Currently in the workforce, we are having a hard time recruiting people and retaining people to stay in the industry. And that's where this bill comes into play. So what House Bill 1132 does is it gives childcare workers who work for a licensed facility the ability to qualify for childcare assistance if they are at the 300% federal poverty line or below. And why that's really important is we know that people are leaving the childcare industry if they cannot afford their own childcare for their own kids.
All right, so we are talking on a Monday after you came out of committee, and this is going to go up on the Senate on Tuesday for debate there. So check sdpb.org/news for the latest updates on anything that's happened since Representative Healy and I have spoken. But Leader Healy, tell me a little bit about what you heard in the committee and why it's giving you some encouragement right now.
Yeah, what we heard in committee is that we know that something has to be done. Today specifically, there was a question asked about other states and if this is working in other states. North Dakota just passed a bill similar to this, I believe, within the past year or two. So we haven't really seen much out of North Dakota, but Kentucky has seen some amazing results with similar legislation where it has really helped strengthen the workforce industry within childcare. So that's one thing that we heard in committee. The other thing that we've been hearing in committee is that we just need to strengthen the workforce behind the workforce. We need to concentrate on making sure that this industry is able to be reliable and stable in order for other working adults to be able to go to work and to be able to have a safe and reliable place for their children to go.
So there will be a ripple effect. How is that measured? Have you seen that measured in Kentucky, for example? Like, how do you quantify that?
That's a great question. I don't have the answer for you right now. Can definitely look into that. That's just what the child care folks who really understand this issue have been saying.
Yeah.
I'm sure they have the numbers to prove that. But we do know that if you are able to increase the workers because they're saying they're leaving because of their own child care problems. If you're able to increase workers, you're now providing potentially up to 14 slots for children now to enter into that facility or that provider's home.
So it's not just that you're going to go into this field and take care of your own kids and have that subsidized. It's that will then maybe open a new room for other kids to come. Do I understand that correctly?
That's correct. So what we currently know is there are facilities and providers who have the capacity, who have empty rooms right now, and they're not able to fill them with children because they do not have the workers with our current ratio set in order to have those kids there.
Yeah.
So what this bill should also help with, it kind of will be a rippling effect. One, we'll be able to get workers through the doors, so we'll be able to open up more slots. That should help access. But two, we all know affordability is a large part of this too. If we're able to employ more people to work within a provider, whether that's a facility or a group home or an in-home daycare, that is potentially going to lower the costs because you have more children working under that ratio and working under that one worker.
Yeah. I think that what you just said is going to answer this next question, but I do want to make sure we specifically address some of the criticism about the bill from the opponents. And one was that you're choosing winners and losers here, that you're helping the child care providers, but you're not, providing a subsidy for a healthcare worker or for, someone who is in another essential service. Is there anything else you would like to add to, your response to that, other than the fact that, there might be more room for those healthcare workers and such to find affordable daycare? Is that pretty much the response to that criticism?
Yeah, I definitely think that would be the response to that criticism. And we have to remember who we're talking about here. Child care assistance is for low-income families. We are not asking for those child care workers who we also want to qualify. We're not asking for much. The current level of child care assistance is 209% federal poverty line. We're just simply upping it a little bit to 300% for child care workers because, again, they're the workforce behind the workforce. And in order to solve the child care crisis, we need those folks at the table.
How is the program paid for? What does this look like in the state budget or in appropriations?
Yeah, great question. So this is federal assistance money comes down to us to utilize. So it shouldn't impact our state budget unless DSS wanted to expand in order to cover folks who might not be covered now that we are expanding this to child care workers. I will say there is not a wait list. Everyone is being taken care of right now. So that is really hopeful that we potentially won't be hurting, the pool of applicants.
Sure.
And I'll also add that child care workers already are underpaid as well. So they probably already qualify. And again, I'll mention Kentucky. Kentucky, that was a state where most of those child care workers had already qualified, but what that bill did was it opened everybody's eyes to the fact that child care assistance exists and that they now can apply for it. So chances are they probably already fall into the category of qualifying and are eligible for child care assistance.
And one more thing about people who say we're letting employers off the hook, that these business owners are the ones who should be, contributing to child care assistance. What's your response to that criticism of this legislation?
Yeah, maybe we are, but I would just say this is one tiny piece of the puzzle. It is not going to solve the problem that we have, but it is definitely going to help. We are working on other solutions. We're working on public-private partnerships. We're working with different cities and foundations and nonprofits that can help. There's going to have to be a lot of discussion about what we can do in order to fix this crisis. And I agree that businesses should be a part of that. We're still working on those businesses. We're trying to convince them that they too should take part in this discussion. And I think we're moving in a positive direction with the South Dakota Chamber supporting this legislation and different chambers throughout the state that are also supporting it.
Yeah, so that is where we should go next, which is what's next, even if the fate of this bill is still up in the air. And again, people can look at sdpb.org for the latest on it. What are you hearing from the conversation and from these efforts over the past few years, really, that give you encouragement that the conversation will keep going and other solutions will continue to emerge?
Yeah, I think what makes me hopeful is the fact, like I just said, that the South Dakota Chamber of Commerce is a proponent of this legislation. I think having such a large entity that has a lot of power in this state, understanding this topic, that they're going to continue to also help us get the word out about what's needed, about how we can accomplish some of these major challenges that we're facing. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers today. I don't think anyone does. We do have some ideas, and we have some ideas of what's worked in other states. And a group of us, there's a whole task force that is focusing on this, and we've been meeting for a few years now. Yeah. We're going to continue to be in discussion with other states, with our stakeholders here in South Dakota about what's best for South Dakota and what we can do to push this issue forward.
Representative Aaron Healy from District 10 talking about HB 1132. We'll take a break. When we come back, we look at a case before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Today, a unique case is before the U.S. Supreme Court, Smith & Wesson Brands Incorporated versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a lawsuit that Mexico is bringing against U.S. gun manufacturers. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio to dive into the complexities of the case. So Mexico is suing United States gun manufacturers, not just Smith & Wesson, a whole host of them, basically saying you are causing problems with illegal trafficking for the cartels in Mexico, and you know it.
Right. You know. You're aiding and abetting the cartels in their criminal activity by providing them with weapons.
Knowingly
providing them with weapons. Well, knowing that they're getting them and that they're using them for this illegal activity. Yeah. It is interesting. The country of Mexico suing these American manufacturers of weapons for money, for damages caused by the weapons in Mexico. And I didn't know this before I read it. It comes from the facts of the case. Mexico has one gun store in the entire country. And Mexico gives out like 50 gun permits per year.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was amazed at that.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did not know that.
It was a fact that the court found. So yeah, Mexico is saying we got to do something about this. And
okay.
I guess
so
we'll look northward.
There has to be some protections for manufacturers of American products, including guns. What's on the books already that manufacturers say, nah, this isn't going anywhere?
Right. Congress passed the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, PLCAA, Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. That essentially prohibits any lawsuit in any federal or state court against a gun manufacturer for the results of the use of the weapon.
Right. This is an act from 2005. So it's been around for a minute.
Yep, it is.
So help me get my mind around how this ends up in the Supreme Court then. If this law protects manufacturers, you wouldn't expect that it had gone all the way to the Supreme Court. You would expect it hadn't gone anywhere, but here we are.
Right. So we have the general prohibition, can't sue a gun manufacturer for the use of the weapon. There are some exceptions, of course, to that. There are some exceptions. So Mexico, in case you're ever interested in whether a U.S. statute can apply extraterritorially, This case will answer all those questions. So the court has to determine whether the statute is meant to apply outside of the United States. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, it's going to apply only to conduct that occurs in the United States. So Mexico would have to prove that the bad conduct occurred in the United States.
Yes.
So there is an exception. It's called the predicate exception. So an exception to this act means I can sue a gun manufacturer. So this predicate exception says if the gun manufacturer knowingly violates a statute, they know that a statute forbids their activity and they act in contravention of the statute anyway, they can be sued. So what Mexico does is they allege that the gun manufacturers have aided and abetted the cartels by knowingly selling weapons to people who are prohibited from owning them.
Okay.
So the allegation in Mexico's complaint says that these gun manufacturers know that certain sellers are violating federal law by selling to Mexican nationals.
That is a big accusation.
It's a huge. Well,
I'm going to say alleged like 15 more times during this radio segment because that is a big accusation.
That is a big accusation, and you got to remember the status of the case, the procedural place the case is in. So Mexico has filed its complaint. They've served all the defendants, and the defendants respond by moving to dismiss, saying you can't sue us under this law. So this is in the baby phase of this lawsuit. So the court at this stage has to determine whether the complaint, the document that sets forth Mexico's allegations, whether it creates or shows on its face a plausible case for relief.
Mm-hmm.
Are there reasonable inferences we can draw from the complaint that shows that Mexico has a plausible claim for relief? So, and you're right about the saying the alleged so many times, because Mexico, they would have to prove that the statute was violated.
Yeah.
They would have to prove that it was a knowing violation.
You cannot knowingly sell arms to a Mexican drug cartel. That would be the statute.
That's still a law.
That's still a law.
You can't
open up the warehouse loading dock door and pass out. Yeah,
right.
That's against the law.
That is against
surprise,
the law.
Surprise,
yeah. So.
And the gun manufacturers say, no, we're not doing that.
No, we're not. We don't know. You know, and I think the intent of the law is to save gun manufacturers from the high expenses of litigation.
Sure.
And this would be a very high cost litigation. So Mexico says, okay, here's how we're going to do this. We're going to show that these gun manufacturers know that their dealers are selling to prohibited people. So we've got the knowing violation of the statute. But then they've got to prove two more elements. They've got to prove that sale was a proximate cause of the damage Mexico has suffered.
Okay.
So proximate cause means there's got to be a connection mm-hmm. between the sale and whatever damages Mexico is alleging. They say they've lost over $170 million as a result of cartel violence. I don't know how they get that number, where it comes from, whatever. So that proximate cause thing is extremely difficult to show because in general negligence law, proximate cause is destroyed by an intervening cause.
Mm.
So generally, if I sell somebody a gun and they go out and through intentional criminal activity kill somebody, that cause, that killing, is an intervening cause and destroys the proximate cause. So I can't be liable for that use.
Mm-hmm.
So Mexico is saying we can show that proximate cause. We can show that one that illegal sale is one of the reasons why we have suffered this loss, these damages.
Mm.
So this court said, you know, that's plausible based on what you've said.
So the facts and all the evidence hasn't come forward yet?
We don't know anything.
Because we're just trying to figure out if the case could go forward.
Right. The court is doing is reading the complaint, reading Mexico's complaint, their allegations, and deciding whether based on reasonable inferences I can take from that,
yeah,
is there a plausible claim for relief?
Yeah.
And, of course, some reasonable minds can differ on
right,
that.
Sure.
And that's why we're going up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Because one of the questions is, where are all these guns coming? I mean, they're all coming from America.
Yeah.
A certain percentage of them are. And so we have to see the evidence of that.
Right.
We need more information.
And Mexico, in its complaint, talks about these gun manufacturers making these military-grade weapons. Mexico also alleged that these weapons manufacturers were selling machine guns to the cartel. But the court says, no, you're not going anywhere with that because it doesn't fit the U.S. Supreme Court's definition or the ATF's definition of a machine gun. But
okay,
you do sell these weapons that look military grade, they have high capacity magazines, all this other stuff. So that does show kind of an intent to supply a military.
Marketing.
Yeah.
Does that matter?
Yeah. In this case, it would matter.
In what way? Yeah.
To show whether they knew
right,
that the guns were going to go to somebody they shouldn't go to, like Mexico.
So if they're are they marketing? We don't know.
Yeah, we
are they marketing to show that this is a potential usage of it? And if they were, I don't know what that ad would look like. Or that,
I know.
That,
I don't.
But if they were, would that show an intent, or would that just show? Oh no, we could.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point. The Mexico would not have to show that the arms manufacturers intended necessarily.
Right.
They would just have to show that they knew that they have some dealers. Their level of mens rea wouldn't have to be as high as intent. It would just have
okay,
to be, you know, maybe they're getting there, maybe they don't. I don't know.
Yeah.
We're not going to pay attention.
If you were a gun manufacturer, would you be worried when you look at this particular?
Well,
and by worried, I mean, would you be worried that you're going to have to spend a whole bunch of money litigating this in the future?
After this, without the Supreme Court weighing in, I'd be really worried about paying a whole bunch of money.
Yeah.
Because you're right, you're going to get into evidence of marketing, how they market, how their dealer systems work. You're going to get into, you have to get into all that. That's why I think the Supreme Court's going to say, no, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
This doesn't create a plausible claim.
That's Mike Thompson, Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Sioux Falls. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments on Smith & Wesson versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos today. Teacher Talk is after the break. You're on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Social-emotional learning is a natural part of human development. People are always learning how to function among others and how to handle our own emotional selves. We're talking with Jackie Wilbur and Gina Benz today about the importance of social-emotional learning in the classroom. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public schools in 2007, and she has served as a middle school and high school teacher and a public librarian. She's an experienced registered yoga teacher through Yoga Alliance. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English Language at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She's also on the adjunct faculty at several colleges and universities. She's the recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. I was just telling our producer, Ari Youngeman, who studied education, that it would be such a gift to study education in college because you would come out as a better person. That's my impression of teachers who are studying education today. There's so many opportunities in that learning, Jackie Wilbur, to just be a better person, to be a little kinder, to be a little more self-aware, to be a little friendlier, to be a little more nurturing, to understand how human beings work. Makes me want to go back to college and start all over again.
Well, you're welcome anytime. We would love to have you. And what a ringing endorsement. That means so much to hear. I like to think so too. I think college is a great investment. I think it is the way people can become who they want to be if that feels like the right path to them. But I do feel like a major in education is a way to improve your whole self.
All right. And this is, and I think partially I'm inclined to things that are categorized and, you know, outlined and put in little packages and orders. And Gina Banzi, you bring us social emotional learning, which has, you know, these headlines and different ways that you can help kids. Tell me a little bit about overall what is social emotional learning.
I wanted to do this episode, this blog post, because we hear social emotional learning a lot in the news. People have opinions about it, school board meetings. It comes up, especially with public input, but there's a lot of misconceptions about it or limited understanding of its full scope. So I've been excited to do this, but also had a little bit of trepidation because some people use it as a way to attack schools.
Oh, okay. Because it's not just academic learning. It's not listening to your multiplication tables and memorizing them.
Yeah, let me put it this way. The multiplication tables, knowing the capitals of the state, being able to solve algebra equations, those are hard skills. Social-emotional learning are the soft skills.
Okay.
And soft skills certainly get taught in the home quite a bit. But there's certain soft skills that you can't teach in the home because the home isn't full of diverse people economically, culturally. The home isn't full of large groups of people typically. And so school presents another opportunity to help students develop soft skills, therefore, you know, social skills, emotional skills.
Yeah. You don't have to probably stand in line in your house.
Unless
you have 14 kids. Yep. And, you know, that's just how you're lining up to get food or something. Mm-hmm. But most of us don't stand in line at home. What is the purpose of a line? How do we behave in line? Mm-hmm. That sort of thing would be sort of a social emotional skill.
Turn taking. If there's a class discussion, if you're working in a small group, how do you not dominate the group or also just not participate in the group? How does everyone participate equally?
Sure. Yeah, so that might be different in a family. We all participate in a family this way. And in school, in a small group, we participate like this. Mm-hmm. And there might be different rules. Mm-hmm. Jackie, how do you describe to people what social emotional learning is?
I agree. I think soft skills is a really great way to describe it because we're familiar with that term from a work lens. And so it makes sense, I think, to a large group of people to hear the term soft skills. I also think that thinking about the fact that folks need to be in a space and able to put themselves ready to learn. Mm. So if you're feeling really angry or if you're having a very bad day or you're particularly sad and you don't have the skills to deal with your own emotions, it becomes difficult to learn. And so social emotional learning is also a lot about self-awareness for individual folks to be able to learn how to deal with themselves so that they can be in a space that's ready to learn.
Okay. You can take that to work. Mm-hmm. If you're having a stressful day or if you're stressed out about anything in the world, the weather, politics, something happening in your family, your health, how do you put yourself in a space where you're ready to work or contribute to the office? When do you need to go home? So we use these skills throughout our entire lives.
Yeah, and I would like to add that it also encompasses, I like to say, how to function among and within. How to function among other people and how to function within yourself. And so, yes, it's how to manage your emotions. It's also how to make sure everybody in a community sees their value and that you are contributing to that sense that everyone has value in a community. Mm-hmm. And then when that's in place, people are less likely to feel angry or defensive or, you know, something that breaks down the community.
Right. Or that they don't want to be there and they call in sick, you know, for example, or they can't. Yeah. All right. So you've got some stuff that's broken out here and we're going to go through these piece by piece. Self-awareness.
Yeah. So self-awareness is being able to accurately identify what's going on inside of you. So for instance, if somebody's really angry, what's at the heart of that? Is hunger or sleepiness contributing to that? Mm-hmm. Or is it that the person doesn't feel valued? Is it that the person was betrayed?
Sure.
So if you can get to the heart of it, rather than just having the explosive anger, it leads to eventual resolution and learning from the experience.
Yeah. So I didn't sleep last night. It was one of those nights where I woke up at 2 o'clock. I had a stomach ache. I didn't feel well. And I remember thinking at the time, hey, tomorrow you're going to be a little tired. So make sure you drink extra water or make sure that you, I mean, I changed my alarm to get up 30 minutes later just because I was aware that that was going to have an impact because I'm not 18 anymore and I can't just get up and go when I've been up at 2 o'clock. So that's an example of just being aware.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit tired today. Came to work, told my coworkers, a little bit tired today. Everybody sympathized and we went about our day and
And you're an adult, and so you have those strategies in place, but teachers have kids, and we have to explicitly teach those strategies.
These are skills that you can learn, and teachers can learn how to teach the skills.
That's right, because not maybe some people come by it naturally, but not everybody.
Yeah. What do you see often, Jackie, like in a library, some self-awareness things that that kids might need to be told explicitly and taught?
In a library is an interesting question. I'm going to think about that for a second. I mostly am thinking about self-awareness in terms of not everyone always knows the volume of their voice, for instance, in a library. So self-awareness would be recognizing how loud you might be sounding to other folks or how much you're touching things, right? Like young people really like to touch a lot of the things in the library, and having awareness that you're pulling things or touching a lot of stuff might be part of it. But the library also has a lot of resources for self-awareness. Identifying feelings is very age appropriate at any level, but it's really something that 3 to 5 year olds focus on, learning the names of different feelings and the expressions that go along with them. You know, that when you're sad, you frown or you cry. And when you're angry, you might look more red and hot. Those giving the language to young people is very much available to parents and kids in the library with books that are appropriate for students of that age.
I love that. Yeah. Inside Out was a big movie for a reason. People liked how so much of that was like, this is what anger looks like. This is what joy looks like.
And let's remember that of all the emotions in that movie, joy was only like the one we consider what we want.
Sure.
But all the other emotions are valid too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Joy didn't overtake it all,
right?
All of the other ones are valid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's self-awareness, but then there's self-management, which is one step up from self-awareness. My voice is loud in the library, and now I can manage that in an appropriate way. Mm-hmm. Gina, tell me about self-management for students.
In a very practical way, I think about deadlines.
Mm.
You know, and we've talked about late work in a previous podcast, and so sometimes deadlines just can't be met, but mostly we do try to meet deadlines, and self-management is part of that. Setting goals, maybe setting small goals along the way, having some self-discipline, having organizational skills, these are self-management things we have to explicitly teach children.
Yeah. And that can be fun. I mean, that's why I'm saying I think it'd be great to be a teacher, because Jackie, you can teach a student that kind of self-management, see them accomplish it, and see them acknowledge right away that they learned something that to you as an adult comes fairly naturally.
One of my...
Maybe.
That's a great point. Very, very good point there. One of the things I liked about teaching middle school was watching students grasp something that now as an adult person felt very... understandable. I remember I had a student who got a haircut, and they were really having a lot of anxiety and fear about this new haircut, and they were having a really bad day. And so I said, do you want to go talk to the counselor about your haircut, and then you can come back? So they did, and they came back, and they were a changed person. And they were like, you know, the counselor talked to me, and it's really about what's on the inside, not about what's on the outside. And we're a more mature person from having had this conversation. And I feel like I've heard that idiom countless times in my life, but it was clearly the first time this young person had heard it, and it helped them work through their feelings about their haircut. It was very sweet.
What I love about that is that a reminder that sometimes you have to be told that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you just have to, or reminded.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes you just have to be taught. Oh, yeah, that, by the way, that's not the defining, you know, feature of you right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Responsible decision making.
So the quote from CASEL, which is the organization that put all of this together, which, and that stands for Collaborative for academic, social, and emotional learning.
Okay.
The quote I like from their website is that responsible decision making is for personal, family, and community well-being.
Mm.
And I like that it's not just about making good decisions for me. My decisions also affect everyone else.
Right.
And so I like the emphasis on community. I think we can help students with responsible decision making by giving them practice in analysis, giving them practice in critical thinking. And then also schools are, especially for me at the high school level, are good at helping students become part of a community. We have so many clubs. And, you know, there's like a rock climbing club at my school in South Dakota.
Love that.
There's a crafting club.
Sure.
And then, of course, you have all, you know, you can just go to a concert. You can go to a game. And all of this is creating community and realizing that we are in this together.
Yeah. Jackie, what would you add to responsible decision making?
Well, I think you articulated it with expressing that you were tired and all of the adjustments that you made to deal with the fact that you were feeling tired today. Those are all examples of responsible decision making, but those have to be taught. Many students wake up tired and then feel like they can just behave however they need to behave to cope with the fact that they're feeling tired.
Right.
And I mean, I feel that way sometimes too, I understand, but that's a learned skill to say, just because I'm feeling tired doesn't mean I get to act recklessly. I have to be responsible still with my actions and adjust accordingly, and then hopefully try to get more sleep another night so that I'm not feeling tired again.
Yeah. All right. Relationship skills.
I think schools are really important in helping students develop their relationship skills because, again, in your home, there's a certain homogeneity. Did I say that word right?
Sure.
They're kind of the same in many ways. And at school.
This is your family. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's differences, but mostly the same. And at school, you get to encounter people who have very different experiences in life. And that's positive because when you hear someone's story, when you get to know someone different, it really does change everything. It generates more understanding, more perspective. And so for relationship skills, one thing I like to do in the classroom is set up a lot of scenarios where students are talking with the person beside them, talking with an established small group, talking with a new small group, so that they have that time to bond with each other in the classroom.
Yeah, yeah. Jackie, relationship skills.
I think relationships are really key to most successful endeavors, right? We don't go through this alone. We go through it together as a community. And very few jobs are jobs that work in isolation. Almost all jobs require us to work in relationship with others. The way our society is structured is that we often pair up, have spouses, have families. We are in relationship. And so learning how to do that and do that well is not something that's inherent. It's something that we have to teach and practice. And so and then in the actual learning, too, think about a group assignment, a paired assignment, all of these kinds of ways that we are, as educators, are expected to teach students to work together for the purposes of learning. You can't do that if you don't know how to be in relationship. So it's a key skill.
Ooh, I have something to add to that.
Please. Always.
Do you remember how, you know, I can't remember how long ago it was when we talked about group projects. And I was I was the kid who hated the group project because I had to do all the work. And then maybe I was a perfectionist because I didn't want to get a C. If I'd only done my part, we would have gotten a C, blah, blah, blah. The light bulb moment for me with this was like, now that would be taught differently than when I was in school 800 years ago and we were just set amongst ourselves. Now you would sit down in your classroom, Gina, and you would say, here are the expectations. Here's how to work in a group. That was a learned skill that I wasn't really, we learned by experience without a lot of guidance, and educators have come a long way. And now if I was in a school, I probably would have a much different experience with a group project.
Yes, I give very clear instructions about what's expected of everybody, and I monitor that. I inspect what I expect.
Yeah, yeah, and I just didn't happen to have that experience in my memory.
Yeah.
It was a free-for-all.
I think most of us didn't.
Yeah.
That was the time.
Yeah. I want to be fair to the teacher that I had that maybe I wasn't paying attention or something, but I don't think so. I think I think it was a free-for-all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the lessons that I always liked was assigning roles ahead of time, where we would say, like, someone in this group is going to be kind of the project lead. And these are the types of things that a project lead will do with this assignment. Another person's going to be more of a researcher, and these are the kinds of things that they will do. It's a way of teaching students how roles kind of naturally come together in the workforce anyway. And then there's always room for negotiation. Like, maybe your researcher is also a really good writer, and so you're going to have them write some of the things. But students aren't going to inherently know what they haven't been through these experiences before, right? They have not done these types of activities. And so you do have to teach these are the ways that roles get formed and what they might look like, so that way they can know what is expected of them.
Yeah. Hats off, educators, for improving how this works over the years.
And it makes our lives easier in the end, too.
Oh, I bet.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I bet this. Okay, social awareness.
This one is helping students learn just about the different cultures that are out there, the different ways of life, just recognizing that everyone doesn't do life the way you do life necessarily. And it doesn't necessarily make different isn't necessarily wrong. And so my favorite thing about this is reading books is a huge way to help students gain social awareness, because they step into the shoes of somebody totally different from them. And I like to do that very intentionally in my classroom, because how can you really, I'll never be able to understand what it's like to be a teenager who is Jewish in New York City. But when I read The Chosen by Chaim Potok, I get a little glimpse into it, and it gives me more understanding, more perspective.
Yeah. Mm. Jackie, is it books? Is it conversation? Is it forming those relationships? How do you handle social awareness?
Yes, and all of the above, right? I think anytime, movies, TV, obviously you have to be aware of what's being depicted accurately and what's being depicted, you know, in a fictitious sense. But I think a lot of fiction still teaches us about social awareness, because it gives us a glimpse into what it might be like.
Yeah. This is why I love Fred Rogers when I was little. Because he was modeling that that structure to a day that I found very appealing, where he'd come in, he would change his sweater, he would take off his shoes, he would put on his sneakers. You know, he would feed the fish. You got the impression that there was routine and structure, and that was a kind, loving thing to have in your life. And so I really liked that.
And he would have guests as well from all different walks of life, which also taught me, probably taught you, the value in getting to know all sorts of different people, which is one of the reasons I love teaching, because I get to know so many different people.
Yeah. And it was groundbreaking, because
it was groundbreaking. We had Officer Clemens and Mr. Rogers, and Officer Clemens both put their feet in a pool, and pools had been segregated at one time. But there was a message there that we can both be in the pool.
Yeah, we can both put our feet. Isn't this nice? Doesn't this feel nice to be sitting side by side and our feet in a little wading pool? And everything was good and right with Mr. Rogers.
Oh, I loved
love
him.
That show.
Yeah, I know, me too.
All right, social emotional learning. That's a one of the, I think, would have to be one of the best parts about being a teacher.
You know what? I think there's some teachers who get scared when they hear that, because because we still need more education about what it is.
What it is, yeah.
And and they get scared that it has to do with counseling.
Okay.
Or,
well, let's close with that. What is it not? How do you, because, I mean, I'm not in the classroom, so to me this isn't scary. This is exciting. But if I was a new teacher and I'd be like, oh, you know, I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to get accused of, you know, doing something I'm not supposed to be doing, or put a target on my back. And also, I don't want to be a counselor therapist. That's not my job title. Where do I draw that line between I'm working on social emotional learning and I'm being someone's parent, or I'm being someone's counselor?
I like to go back to the term soft skills. Okay. When my daughter was in her opening convocation for college, there was a special speaker who said hard skills will get you hired, but it's the soft skills that keep you from being fired.
Okay.
And so I like to go back to soft skills. Remember that we're teaching students how to manage themselves, how to be aware of others, how to make responsible decisions, how to form healthy, positive relationships. Yeah. And this gives students more options and opportunities in their life because they have now the hard skills and the soft skills.
Okay. In my daughter's college convocation, the speaker talked about how you would encounter ideas at this university that would offend you and bother you, and you will fight against the presence of those ideas being spoken, and you will lose.
Oh, yeah.
A slightly different tone.
That's a different tone, but it's true. You know, you can hear another perspective. You don't have to agree with it, but
right.
it's important to hear it.
Yes. All right, Jackie Wilbur, anything left on social emotional learning that you want to close with?
Yeah, I think one of the misconceptions that I had and I've heard is that it's an extra thing, right? I'm already having to teach all of these standards.
Sure.
I'm already doing all of this work, and now I have to teach, you know, social emotional learning on top of it. Yeah. And what I would say to that is that I found that it was not an extra, it was embedded. It's mm-hmm. part of classroom management.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you're not teaching self-awareness, you are reminding the same student who is speaking too loudly over and over again that they're speaking too loudly, right? Because that is happening. So if you can teach the awareness of noticing for themselves when they're speaking too loudly, then you have helped yourself with some classroom management issues, right? And so that's how I always looked at it, was I'm dealing with these things anyway. If there's relationship conflict, if there's a lack of social awareness in my classroom, I have other issues that are going on that I'm addressing regardless. And so to me, it was just an additional set of skills and tools that I could use to help with my classroom management.
Yeah. How do you teach organizational skills and then also leave room for the fact that some people like to organize in different ways?
Right. That's self-management, right?
Yeah.
This is me learning how to manage my own self and still stay organized.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if I'm answering your question,
you
provide options. Here's what works for me. Here's what I know some other people do. And then you inspect what you expect, and you make sure you keep an eye on what the students are choosing. Yeah. Let me also just say, Jackie, that was perfect, because I think about how I've incorporated timers into my classroom. And I know elementary teachers have done this for a long time. So I tell students, you know, talk about this for 4 minutes or write for 5 minutes.
Right.
And it helps them manage themselves. I also love when there's deadlines to remind students the reason for the deadline is for my well-being, so that I don't grow bitter and so that I can manage my workload. But it's also for your well-being so that you can end one unit before you have to begin another one.
You can find this episode and more on SDPB's Teacher Talk. It's a podcast that celebrates teachers and education. Find SDPB's Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform, and find the companion blogs on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's In the Moment, we dive back in to the legislative session. We've got Attorney General Marty Jackley, Representative Will Mortensen, Dakota political junkie Jonathan Ellis. We'll bring you the latest reporting and insight from PEER. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.